You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
That's right. Earlier I spoke with Professor Jane Kelsey of the University of Auckland Law Department. We caught up over the TPPA and I started by asking Jane what's happened over the last week and if she could explain a little bit of the controversy developing between Japan and Canada.
A week before these meetings in Vietnam, there were some meetings in Japan to try to finalise what the 11 countries without the US would do. And they had 50 items on the agenda there, and they were looking at suspending those items from the agreement pending the US re-entering if and when it ever did. There were some small items and a number of things that were agreed to and a number that weren't that then got deferred for the officials to discuss further in Vietnam. They didn't reach a conclusion despite very late night meetings and it got kicked on to the ministers. Japan has been the one that has been pushing super hard to get a deal, largely because Prime Minister Abe has spent so much political capital on this. But in some areas, he's also acting, ironically, as a proxy for the US, for example, in relation to intellectual property, which the pharmaceutical industries and so on in the US still want to benefit from, even if they're not in the deal. Then there was some announcements that came out late last night from the Japanese trade minister and the Mexican one, reported in the media that they had reached an agreement in principle. And indeed, even in the Japanese one said that they would have a signing in Japan in January. And then the Canadian trade minister tweeted, "No, we haven't." And so I think what we've got is a classic exercise of Japan's brinkmanship in trying to push ministers into accepting what Japan has been demanding, which is an outcome with minimal changes, and the Canadians have stood up to them.
What are some of the issues that Canada might be finding prominent with the agreement currently, to the point where they're wanting to go out there and publicly say, no, we have not reached an agreement?
Canada has some quite unique issues. It has some concerns around culture, in particular in relation to films and music and broadcasting and so on. And the US, on behalf of Hollywood and the likes, has always resisted those being in the agreements. And so that's one thing Canada's been after. It also has some sensitive issues in the way that it runs some of its agriculture. Dairy and poultry, for example, and it's been wanting changes on that. And it's been wanting a number of other things that, because it's engaged in a renegotiation of another agreement known as NAFTA, or the North American Free Trade Agreement, with Trump and Mexico, it's wanting to kind of cover its bases and not give stuff away in TPPA that it might want to protect in NAFTA. So there's a bit of a chess game there as well. But the important thing is, just like in New Zealand, you had a new government, the Trudeau government, that wasn't the one that negotiated the original deal. And they are saying, we need the time, the opportunity and the right to go back as a new government and look at this again to see what is important in our national interest.
Is it realistic to think that 10, 11 or more or so countries can have an agreement of this nature when they run domestic institutions which change every 3 to 4 or 5 years depending on their term? Because just in the process of negotiation, we've seen America pull out, we've seen sort of small turnarounds from New Zealand and Canadian governments, and we're seeing places like Japan really trying to push it from a government that has been in power through the negotiation process. Is it realistic to think that if something was signed, it could actually sustain through the future?
Well, that's the whole purpose of the agreements. The purpose of the agreements is to put handcuffs on governments so that when governments change, albeit with a democratic mandate to do something different, they're pre-committed to maintaining a certain position and that they can suffer either economic sanctions in terms of changing trade rules or financial penalties and damages in the case of foreign investors suing them. That's the whole purpose of this. And so there is a fundamental collision between democracy and the purpose of these agreements, especially when they're conducted in secret. But there's also a fundamental collision between notions of sovereignty, and that one government now can't bind a government of the future, and that states are sovereign to decide their own future direction, and agreements that are designed to remove very significant parts of the autonomy of sovereign states.
Looking at New Zealand, we have seen protests and marches over the last several years about the TPPA. Is this a trend across the countries involved in the agreement, or is this unique to somewhere like New Zealand, where it represents part of our culture to be quite active and involved in these sort of things?
There are very different countries involved here. There have been protests in Japan, but Japanese politics is very different from here. In Canada, there has been deep concern, but they've had three of these mega deals that they've been dealing with, one with the EU, now the review of NAFTA plus the TPPA. In Australia, they have a really serious issue there, because the Australian Labor Party does not support the TPPA, and they haven't been able to get it through the Senate. And there's a really serious question of whether they will be able to again. In that case, there hasn't been the mass protests that we had here, but there's been a very strong political resistance to the terms of the deal. But if you look much broader around the world, you can see that these kinds of hyper-ambitious deals, we call them mega agreements, are running into trouble because they're so audacious, they're so unbalanced, and they're coming at a time when there is this real resistance, especially after the global financial crisis, to the unbalanced kind of economy and society we have. One really good thing a couple of days ago was that the new Trade Minister, David Parker, himself said, we have to stop just pursuing these agreements for the sake of them and notches in the belt, which was the national government's approach, and we need to think about how these agreements fit within a sustainable economic development model where you deal with these questions of inequality and you deal with climate change and so on. And that's really promising. The problem will be that they will have signed away a lot of the ability to do that if they proceed.
Finally, I just wanted to pick up on that idea of the motivations for why we are pursuing these kind of mass multinational agreements. Talking about the Japanese leader Shinzo Abe, he has spent a lot of political capital on this, like you said, and he has lost a lot of political legitimacy in the last couple of years, especially with his wife being involved in the controversy over the schoolhouse, and he has dropped in the polls a lot. Do you think with the United States pulling out of this deal, he is actively seeking to take the reins as the leader in this and sort of regain a little bit of legitimacy for himself rather than for pursuing it out of genuine interest in free trade and raising up the standard of all their states?
I think it is very much a political rather than an economic strategy on behalf of Abe. And indeed, immediately after the US pulled out, Abe said, there is no point in proceeding with this without the US. And then he's done a kind of a recalculation. Part of it is this argument that this provides a bulwark against China. And there are, of course, the big tensions between Japan and China, especially in the maritime arena. And so it's not so much cementing Japan's leadership, although he will probably see it that way, but it's also about neutralizing the potential dominance of China in the region. And I think that's actually a rather crude perception, but you saw the Australian Prime Minister running the same line about 3 days ago, which is a bit of a problem for Australia and New Zealand because we're so dependent on the China market as well. So Abe is undoubtedly looking at this as a way that he can assert Japan's international relevance. We understand he's been having behind the scenes discussions with the US Trade Representative's office about the things that the US really does want to make sure is in there, and which they can probably get the benefit of without actually having to pay any price for it. But Japan has also been extremely aggressive throughout these negotiations, equally aggressive in the parallel negotiations for the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP, It's a worry when you have foreign policy that is being bought through agreements that affect things like the price to medicines and the ability to deal with climate change and so on.
So potentially we're seeing a modern form of realpolitik playing itself out through liberally covered ideas, I suppose is what I'd call it.
Yes, I think we have moved away from any pretense that this is actually about free trade. Of course, for the TPPA, there's only about five or six of the 30 chapters that are about old-fashioned commodity trade. It's much more about rules that are going to promote the commercial interests of various players and about clubs of countries forming like-minded coalitions in a pretty turbulent world.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.